Hello, I'm Megan Morris-Carter, Director of The Hill. Welcome to Series 3 of our Digital Innovation podcast. The Hill supports an ecosystem of startups, scale-ups, partners, and clinical staff interested in digital innovation, as well as managing a pipeline of innovation into Oxford University hospitals and the wider NHS. Our work supports better patient care through technology and innovation. This series explores some of the technologies that are at the cutting edge of healthcare delivery through the medium of the entrepreneurial journeys of some of the founders in our community, as well as the clinicians they have worked with to pilot their technologies. So today on the podcast, I'm joined by Natalie Cook, who is the co-founder and CEO of Surgery AI. Welcome, Natalie.
Thanks, Megan. It's a pleasure to be here.
So Natalie, can you start by introducing yourself and, of course, your startup?
I am Natalie. I'm co-founder and CEO at Surgery AI, and my background is as a registered nurse. So I worked in the NHS for many years before starting this company, and I also did a master's in healthcare management, which helped sort of set the foundations for the skills that I've needed for building this company.
And can you tell us a bit about what Surgery AI does?
At Surgery AI, we're on a mission to bring down waiting list times for treatment. And we do this with a smart scheduling solution that helps hospitals automatically schedule high volumes of patients in the most efficient way. And the smart part comes in with machine learning algorithms, which we train on past surgery data. And we use these to then make accurate predictions on future surgery times.
That's fantastic. And I'm sure it will be incredibly useful in some of the departments in Oxford University hospitals. And I know you've already had some interest from the hospital in trialing the solution, which is fantastic. Let's talk a little bit about you before we delve into a little bit more on the startup and how your machine learning algorithms work. Can you tell us a little bit about your story? How did you end up going from being a registered nurse to being an entrepreneur?
Yeah, it wasn't a very straightforward journey. I don't think anyone's ever is, but I realized that it all started when the entrepreneurship journey began when I became a nurse. And I think nurses are a little bit underrated in the sense that I would say nurses are incredibly innovative naturally, and their job requires them to be innovative and to find solutions to problems. I would say that the biggest part is that as a nurse, you can have an impact on people and many people's lives. And yet what I realize is that you can't have, or you can't create, or not easily at least, system-wide change. And I think that is what I really wanted to achieve and still haven't. But I feel like I'm a little bit closer now. So I would say that's where the journey began.
How did you find kind of becoming an entrepreneur? Did it surprise you? Were there things that surprised you about being an entrepreneur?
Definitely. I mean, I think the amount that I've learned, and I know a lot of people talk about how much you will have to learn when you become an entrepreneur, but I think it's not clear the quantity of learning that you do until you're actually in that position. And I would say that is one of the parts about being an entrepreneur that I love the most, is the amount of learning. And I'm quite a curious person, I would say. And so this is one of my favorite parts of this role, is the amount of constant learning. And even in an environment like The Hill and this, the Market Access Accelerator, there's a huge amount of access to experts and to individuals and people that have so much knowledge in areas that I didn't even know about.
And have you found some things that are quite easy to pick up and other things perhaps a bit more challenging? Or?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, there's definitely some easier and harder parts. I would say that in terms of the harder parts for me is prioritizing when you have so many tasks. There's a constant juggle of things to do. And I think the deciding on, you know, whether to practice your pitch deck or reach out to more investors, or whether to focus on your annual accounts or on your VAT return, there's a lot of juggling that happens, and the prioritization of that is sometimes complicated. I would say on the easier side, the adaptability and the unpredictability, so adapting to change. I think that helped from my career as a nurse, is being used to not knowing what's going to happen next. And the unpredictability of, I think life's quite unpredictable in general. One of the most important moments that I noticed that I can handle change quite well is when my previous co-founder left. because I think it could be a make or break point. It could have been a make or break point. And I think it was a point at which I realized that it didn't have to mean the end of the company. It didn't have to mean the end of Surgery AI. And it just was the start of a new chapter. And that, I think, could have been, well, it was a pivotal point, but it could have been pivotal in a different way.
So what's your view about the value of a team when you're setting up a startup? Mm-hmm. Obviously, some people are sole founders, others have co-founders, or, you know, build a team around them quite quickly.
Yeah.
What's been your experience of that, and what do you think is important about the team?
I would definitely say the team is the most important part of the startup. And I think investors will tell you that as well, that they look more at the team than at the idea or the product. And if they believe in the team, then it's likely that they'd invest in you, even if they're like, not quite sure about the product, because the product can change, you can iterate, but the team is what is really valuable. And I know it sounds funny coming from me because the team's changed a little bit, but I'm just very grateful for the team that I have. I think I wouldn't have been able to continue after my previous co-founder left if it wasn't for the two engineers we had hired, thanks to our smart grant. And one of them is actually my co-founder now today, Anna. And so I'm quite proud to say we're a fully female-led team. I would definitely not recommend being a solo founder unless you've been a founder before, because then you probably have the skills and the expertise required to carry a company forward and be successful in that. And you probably have that support network around that makes it okay for you to be on your own. But I would definitely say from my experience, it's been incredibly important for me to have a co-founder. And I would say not only your immediate team, but also the support network around that you get from, you know, accelerators such as The Hill or programs through, for example, Imperial Enterprise Lab, which have been also incredibly supportive, mentorship, advisors, and you can seek that out and find that in a lot of different places. And I would say that's been incredibly important to this journey. You can't do this on your own. And I think as much as you'd like to think as an entrepreneur that you're your own boss and that you sort of can do this on your own, that there's nothing, I don't think you do anything in life truly on your own. And I think people are an incredibly important part of your journey and your eventual success.
I often talk a lot actually about team formation with startups that I've coached now and in the past, because I do think it's really important, and it is the thing that sometimes makes a startup fall apart, is when the team falls apart and the relationships aren't there. I think also in startup land, as in all other aspects of employment, there is a tendency to hire for skills when sometimes what you need to hire for is attitude or vision in a sense. And so one of the things I talk about is the idea that you have a diversity of thought, but a congruence of vision. Mm-hmm. So you're all working towards the same vision, the same wanting to make a difference in a particular area in a particular way. But you still need to have that diversity in terms of skill set and in terms of life experience and things like that to give you those alternative viewpoints when you're stuck on a problem, as it were. But does that ring true for you, do you think? Do you think you have that sort of diversity of thought and experience, but a shared vision?
Definitely. I would say it's incredibly important to be complementary and not choose someone that thinks like you or is going to agree with everything that you say, because there's no value in that, in my opinion. I think definitely you need to have similar values, because as you say, that the direction and the trajectory, I think the goal needs to be the same for the company to be successful. But I definitely think diversity of thought is incredibly important, and complementary skills, so that you're not overlapping and you're not, I mean, it's very important to have different skill sets either way for a successful company. But I think in particular within your team or even co-founding team, that you can challenge each other and bounce ideas off of each other and not end up going down the route of agreeing just for the sake of agreeing and not really being challenged. I think that's really important, to be challenged.
I'm very much the same. I like to be challenged by my team. Mm-hmm. I like to have a diversity of thought in the room and to scrutinize decisions from different perspectives, mm-hmm. because I think it is incredibly important. And I think in the digital health space, it's particularly so, because you've got that sort of machine learning component, that really technical component, but you've also got the experience of the patient, of the clinician, and the really deep knowledge of the clinical environment that you need to be able to understand how that could be applied.
Sure.
And those are two very different skill sets, I think, and two very different backgrounds. And, you know, there are a few people who have both, but often it's about pairing people who have those two different backgrounds and bringing them together to create a successful company, I think.
No, for sure. I totally agree with that. I think having the background as a nurse, having experienced the problem in practice, adds a huge amount of value to the company. But without the technical experience or technical expertise of my team members, there is no way that this would actually be a valuable proposition. And so I think that it's the combination of those skill sets and of those experiences that make the team strong and make the product even stronger.
One of the amazing things you've done is you've actually had a co-founder leave and the company is, if anything, stronger again now. I've seen an awful lot of teams who've not coped with that. And so I think you've done a fantastic job of being able to ride that wave. Can you share a little bit about that experience and kind of how you managed to navigate that to get to a successful conclusion?
Thank you for saying that. I think it was definitely a challenging time. One that definitely made us stronger eventually. I think at the beginning, it doesn't always seem that way. And for me in particular, there was a lot of change happening around that time. And so it can be, I think, like I said a bit earlier, a make or break situation. And I decided to have it as a make situation. I wanted to use that opportunity. And I really did see it as an opportunity to drive the company forwards and potentially make changes where changes needed to be made, but then also hold on to the parts that we had built together with Radovan that were good and that were strong, and there was a good foundation there. But I definitely think with him leaving, I saw it as an opportunity to start afresh, not afresh in the idea or in the company, but just a fresh perspective on what we could do better or what we could improve. And obviously there's a time of adaptation where you need to, you know, figure out a lot of things. But through that, I think you realize how strong your core team is. I was very lucky to have Anna and John there at the time. And we really came together stronger. And I think that's the other thing is to not let it get between you and the other team members, if you have other team members. And if you don't, I just want to say to, you know, people out there who may have gone through a similar situation or maybe in a situation where their co-founder has left, that it doesn't have to mean the end of the company, that there are people out there who are really excited to work on, you know, impactful startups, and it can change for the better. And I think in this case, I would definitely, and not, I mean, all respect to Radovan because he was a really great co-founder and I couldn't have started it without him. And we still have a good friendship and we still stay in touch, and it was kind of reasons beyond his control. So there were really no hard feelings there. And I think it's really important to maintain a good relationship because you never know when, you know, he understands the company probably better than most people having founded it with me. And I think it's really important to maintain that relationship and not hold on to any hard feelings or salty feelings, which then will occupy space in your brain and take away from the purpose of what you're actually doing. And I think what I realized with Radovan, even though it was difficult, was that it doesn't take away the purpose of, or the reason of why I started the company, and that it wasn't, yes, I want to do it with someone and I want to build a company that can provide value, and I know I can't do that on my own. But at the end of the day, my goal stays the same.
Do you have any advice for people who might face a similar situation in terms of, are there things that you did either before the split in terms of how you set up your contracting or your relationships, or during that process, which you sort of think, yes, that was absolutely the right thing to do, or possibly that was the, you know, in some sense, the wrong thing to do. But any tips for other people who might potentially end up in that situation?
I definitely learned a lot through that process. And one thing I would say is have a founder's agreement in place. Have a good founder's agreement, because I think I thought about that a bit later on. I mean, we got along really well. We still get along really well. And so I think sometimes when you start working with someone and you have a good relationship and your company's not really worth anything to begin with, you might think it's not that important. I'll leave this to later because right now we don't really need it. It's time consuming, not worth it. It is worth it. And it's definitely worth getting that in place early on and agreeing on a vesting schedule and what will happen or what would happen if someone were to leave. And what will you do in that scenario? And obviously there's different leaving situations. There can be a good leaver, a bad leaver, a forced leaver. You don't have to go for a lawyer because lawyers are expensive. And I use Seed Legals, which is a lot more affordable. And that's fine to begin with. I think it's important to have lawyers eventually once you can afford it, because they'll be looking at your best interests. Whereas with Seed Legals, it's very generic, but it's totally fine to begin with. And it's a lot better than not having anything. So I definitely say have good contracts in place and also make sure that your values are aligned and that your vision's aligned, because maybe one of you has intentions to keep working on this for 10 years and the other one is planning an exit in 2 years. And that's going to be a little bit challenging if you're not aligned on those points. It's really important to have shared access to obviously not confidential information, but to applications and platforms that you use as a company that will be necessary to continue with, so that the handover is as smooth as possible. I think handover between when someone leaves is actually can be quite challenging. And I think that was one of the time consuming parts of the separation was we had loads of different accounts and everything. So I think that would be something I'd recommend, is maybe using one account or an admin account, or if you don't, then having this sort of shared password to make it as easy as the transition as easy as possible. And even if you don't have to go through that transition, it's really good to have it all in one place anyway.
Yeah, it's probably good practice, isn't it, for a team anyway. But I think it is quite challenging when you're a startup, because as you say, you start off as 2-3 people working together on something. It feels more like a project than a startup to begin with. It feels all very informal. There's a lot of scribbling things in different places and, you know, setting things up in your own name, or, you know, making do with what you've got and straightening that out and making sure that you've got those structures in place once you start to employ people and once you start to grow the company is really important, I think. You also make a really good point, I think, about the founders agreement, which is often something that people miss out. It's very much easier to split the pie at the point where it's not really worth anything than it is later on, when perhaps people start to have a different view about what the startup's going to be worth or how much effort they've put in or whatever else that might be. And I've seen that sort of make startups implode in other circumstances. So as I say, I think you've done a fantastic job of that. Natalie, I'd like to briefly come back to a couple of things you said earlier. One was that you've been part of several accelerator programs. So I think you mentioned Antler. You mentioned obviously the Hills Market Access Accelerator, and I think one other as well. What's the role of those programs for you as an entrepreneur, and how does that help your journey?
Yeah, that's a great question, and they've actually been really instrumental to Surgery AI, and so I would love to mention them. I mean, yes, it started with Antler, and then thanks to Imperial, so that's where I did my master's in Imperial, their enterprise lab has been excellent, and a huge amount of support. I went through their Venture Catalyst Challenge and then was able to pitch in the final there in April. And they've got I get support from their Imperial Venture Mentoring Service, which is really excellent. Shout out to Janet and Ian, who've been an excellent support to the company, but more so to myself even. And then also the NHS Clinical Entrepreneur Program, which is a huge community of other clinical entrepreneurs, but also patient entrepreneurs. And that's been, they do pit stops like once a month, which is where you all come together and you've got sort of got 2 days of workshops and talks and networking opportunities. And it's just an opportunity to be surrounded by a network of like-minded individuals, but also to be challenged and learn and grow and talk to experts in the field. And then as well as, I would say the The Hill so far has been the most engaging in terms of the active clinical engagement with an NHS trust, and the direct link to Oxford University Hospitals has been really valuable. And we've been able to work closely with Ed to be connected with a department in the hospital that where we could have an impact with Surgery AI. And so we're in the process right now of discussing and going through, you know, ways in which we could have an impact on problems that they're experiencing and how Surgery AI could help solve for that, and working closely alongside with them to make sure that we're actually solving a real problem and not trying to impose the solution that we've built onto their problem. So I really like that close working together. I would say these accelerators, I mean, look, there's so many out there, so it can be difficult to choose, and it can be difficult, and I say choose, I mean, you don't always get the luxury of choice, but I think it's really important to take time to find out if it's the right accelerator for you, if you're at the right stage for it, and it can be quite exciting to just apply to all sorts of things, and then you end up spending a lot of time on applications because they can be quite time consuming. And most of the time, it's worth it. It has been for me, at least. But sometimes you can be applying, you can take days to apply to something, and then they come back saying that you were at the wrong stage or it wasn't the right fit. So I think if you take a bit of time beforehand, before applying, to make sure that it's the right fit and that you're at the right stage. But if it is, and it does work and it matches, I would say that these accelerators have been some of the drivers of the company and the network that it's provided, the support, the experts, even just conversations like this have been incredibly valuable to not just the company, but me as well, personally.
And you also mentioned that transition from a nurse, being a nurse and a clinician, to then being an entrepreneur. And I know that our experience actually has been that when we first started offering our programs, we had a lot of doctors who put up their hands and came forward, some allied health professionals as well, but not very many nurses. Mm-hmm. But actually, last year, we ran a Startup Labs program that was geared specifically to nurses, midwives, and allied health professionals. Mm-hmm. And we ended up with over 150 applications, and a lot of them were nurses. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of interest in the program. And that really opened my eyes to the fact that, as you were saying, you know, there's a lot of innovative thought within the nursing community. There's a lot of people there who are thinking about new ideas, new ways of solving mm-hmm. problems. But it can be quite difficult to encourage them to engage with some of the support that's available. I don't know if you have any advice for nurses who might be thinking about mm-hmm. following a similar sort of route. How would you advise them to engage with this sort of support? And do you have any tips for them on how to do it?
That's actually a really great point, Megan, because I would love to encourage more nurses to take the plunge, as I would say, and not be so afraid of actually taking those ideas that they have, because I know a lot of nurses have ideas. And yesterday, actually, for example, I was at the digital nursing event from the Nursing Times, and there's actually so much growth happening in this space for nurses. And I think nurses' voices are starting to be heard more, and the innovation that is happening from nurses, especially on the front line, is so valuable. I would much rather have a solution that's going to be used by healthcare professionals that has been built by a healthcare professional who has been there and who's experienced that. And in terms of things that you can do, would be joining programs like the NHS Clinical Entrepreneur Program, which is really for any idea stage, even if you've just got an idea and you have no idea how to even go from there, because it's really open to any stage, I mean, more early stage, but you don't really have to have any business background. You don't need to even have a team. If you just think this could make a huge difference, and I don't even know where to begin, apply to the program. Or even if you don't want to apply or you don't feel ready to apply, reach out to people who have been on the program. So for example, on LinkedIn, you could just type in the NHSCEP. I would recommend, first of all, reaching out to people, talking to people, because you'd be surprised at how many healthcare professionals turned innovators are happy to share their experience or happy to talk or happy to help. And I think it's about figuring out what would be the best route for you. And I mean, I said this before, but I'll say it again. It doesn't mean that you must leave the profession, and please don't, because we need nurses. And we we need all healthcare professionals, but in particular, we need nurses. And so I don't want this to be like a, you should leave the NHS to start pursuing your, you know, innovative passion. It can be something that you do alongside your work, and it can be something that is made even more impactful by your work or by your experience on the front line. But that would be the first step, I would say, is reach out to people.
I think you make a really good point, actually, that some of the value of that experience is in staying in the profession, continuing to do your clinical work, but then also having that other work that gives you perhaps a sense of personal development and a different set of skills and a different perspective. But also then you can still bring your clinical expertise to bear on what you're developing in your startup. And interestingly, we've been exploring this idea through innovation fellowships. So one of the things that we are doing at the moment, we have a pediatric innovation fellow at the moment who is spending 2 days a week doing innovation projects and 3 days a week doing clinical work. And I think that kind of structure, which of course is quite well developed, I think, particularly for doctors in the academic side. So if you want to do a research career, but perhaps less well developed for nurses and less well developed for innovation activities, is a really valuable way of kind of putting your feet in the water, experimenting with your ideas, developing your ideas without having to leave the clinical mm-hmm. work behind.
No, for sure. I think that's a great initiative. And I think there's actually a lot of other programs that help support your clinical work as well as your entrepreneurial work. And it doesn't have to be one without the other. And actually one company I came across yesterday was called Future Nurse, and they've actually just started this program, which is to help more nurses bring, you know, even who have no idea where to even start, to just a support network and a community of, you know, where do I start? What do I do? And it's different for everyone. So there's not like a one size fits all. But I think there's actually so many resources out there that I would say it's just anyone can start with this support.
So surgery AI, as you've described, is based upon machine learning algorithms. Can you tell us a bit about what machine learning and AI is and what the potential is for the NHS?
I see the potential for AI in healthcare in particular with the amount of time saving. I see time as being a resource that we don't have enough of and the NHS needs more of. And every second counts in the NHS. And I think it's very important that if there are solutions out there that can help save time and then redirect it into areas that need it more, why wouldn't we use that? And understand that there's a fear around AI and that it's not completely fully understood yet. And that creates a lack of trust in healthcare mm-hmm. professionals in particular. And I think that's something that we need to encourage education on so that people understand more what it is and the benefits of it, because I definitely think that the benefits far outweigh the risks. So with surgery AI, we estimate that with currently about 313 million patients going through surgery every year, that could mean between 15 to 30, over 30 million additional patients receiving treatment every year. And with current waiting lists at 6.3 million people for about 7.5 million treatments, so there's individuals waiting for more than one treatment sometimes, that would just blow it out the water.
So can you tell us a bit more about how surgery AI uses algorithms to do the theatre scheduling?
So what happens is we take into account past surgery data. So in particular, the surgeon's past performance, and whether they've worked together with the team before. So we don't want to make any surgeon faster or slower. We're not trying to impact their workflow at all. We just want to take that into account when building the list. And we found that when the surgeon and the team have worked together before, there seems to be some time saving in that if they're used to the people that they're working with. And then we also take into account the patient's past medical history and any characteristics that might impact on the surgery duration, as well as obviously the type of surgery and then the time of day. And those are just a few of the initial inputs that we are taking into account in the model. The great thing about machine learning is the amount of data that it can ingest that is way more than any human can. And I think that is one of the great values, is there's a huge amount of information involved around a procedure, around a treatment, a surgery, and the ability to take all that information to account, to learn that, so that when you're planning or scheduling a future list, you can use all of the past learnings from previous lists in order to build your new list. And that means what we found from our first case study is that you're able to increase the capacity by, well, in our case study, 14%. But obviously, as you can see, it can be more, it can be a bit less. But either way, it's an improvement. It's a huge improvement on efficiency and capacity. There's a huge amount of potential to get more patients treated in the same amount of time without using any additional, not without needing additional infrastructure, without needing to build more hospitals, without needing to hire more staff, just using the time available better. And what we found right now is that time inside operating theaters is not being used to its full capacity. And by using it to its full capacity, ensuring obviously that there is enough buffer. I think that's the other concern is like, if you're maxing out the day, well, when are you going to clean the room? When are people going to take breaks? And we take that into account. And despite taking that into account, so we take into account, you know, a buffer for the start and the end of the day, for preparation time and cleanup time. We also take into account anesthetic time, and then the actual procedure time and the recovery time. So there's multiple different layers to it. But the real added benefit is the ability to automatically schedule these long lists of patients. So if you've got a list of patients waiting to be booked within a certain amount of time, you can select them from the waiting list and automatically schedule them. And what happens is it goes through this machine learning algorithm in the background to make an accurate prediction on the surgery duration, and it's able to generate the most efficient schedule for that week, that month, saving a huge amount of admin time that can then be spent on doing other things, such as, for example, making sure that the patient is actually ready for the surgery, making sure that they've got all the information that they need for the procedure, to ensure they're not going to just not show up. Because obviously there's other things involved around the surgical workflow, not just the actual duration of the procedure.
So what's next for Surgery AI?
So next, we're looking to validate our solution in practice. And we're in discussions with quite a few partners right now to be able to pilot this in an NHS trust, and Oxford University Hospitals being one of them, which we're very excited about. We are in discussion and conversation about piloting, and there's a lot of paperwork involved around getting this up and running and ensuring that the, you know, the data is being protected. And so that is the next step, is to get some real results from NHS data and prove that this can actually have an impact and is actually solving for the problem that we're trying to solve. It's part of a whole surgical workflow, and that includes pre-assessment, ensuring that the patient is ready for surgery, ensuring that the patient actually shows up. So anything that involves preventing cancellations, and then ensuring that when the patient does eventually arrive, that they are informed and aware of the surgery that's about to happen. And then on the recovery side is ensuring that the patient is recovered in the right way, that they don't end up back in the hospital again very shortly after. And the other thing is, if there's no bed for the patient to go to, then there's no real value in optimizing the actual surgery time, because they can't actually have that treatment without a bed being available. So I just wanted to note that it's part of a much bigger workflow. We need to collaborate, or we need to come together with other solutions that are focusing on different areas of the pathway to work together, because it's not a problem that can be solved with one solution. And I want to note that this is something that we're focusing on, because I believe this is something that we can solve for, and you can't do everything. But I really do think that we need to work more closely together with other startups or other companies that are part of this, you know, surgical workflow, as I call it, to ensure the best impact and the best outcome for waiting lists, essentially.
I think you make a very good point there. We obviously support a lot of individual startups with fantastic ideas, but I think the real impact comes when you can look at a whole pathway or a whole system and think about transformation in a larger sense. And I think one of the reasons that we choose to bring together startups into cohorts in our accelerator and also through our networking events is so that there's the opportunity to build those partnerships and to start thinking about a wider and more holistic solution to some of the challenges that are facing the NHS. Thank you so much, Natalie, for joining us on the podcast. It's been an absolutely fascinating episode, and I wish you all the best with Surgery AI.
Thank you, Megan. It's been a pleasure being here.
You've been listening to The Hill's Digital Innovation Podcast. Find out more about our work bringing digital technologies into the NHS at www.thehilloxford.org. You'll see details of our open access events, as well as applications to programmes such as our flagship Market Access Accelerator for startups looking to work with the NHS. Don't forget to also check out Series 1 and 2 of the podcast.